From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Why do so many people mistrust science these days? A Milwaukee expert says there are a lot of things scientists can do to change the dynamic.
Later, one of the joys of singing an opera that's only a few years old.
The thing I like most about doing new opera, new work, is that I don't have 200 years of past recording and experience to have to be compared to. I get to create my own character.
And Madison native John Stotts lives in Colorado now, but his home state is an important part of his songwriting.
It's a real place with beautiful scenery and really nice people and great cities and its share of other, you know, difficulties that I think inspire songs.
An in-studio performance and more. Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. So glad you could be listening today. A few weeks ago, Oklahoma Senator and Chairman of the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee, James Inhofe, took to the Senate floor with a snowball to demonstrate why he thinks climate change is a myth. This week came the news that Florida's government reportedly banned its employees from using the terms climate change or global warming in its official documents.
Here at home, public health officials in Milwaukee are encouraging people to get their children vaccinated against measles in the face of an outbreak that's caused in part by large numbers of people who don't believe that vaccines are safe. And it was a couple of weeks ago when Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker spoke to members of the international media and declined to answer whether he believes in evolution.
It's a challenging time for scientists, especially those who look to the public to fund and support their research. But how did the divide over science open up in this country? It's a situation that interests Andrew Petto. He's a senior lecturer in science education, evolution education, and anatomy at UW-Milwaukee, and he's on the board of governors for the National Vaccine Education Project. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mitch.
How do you see the divide that is open in this country over science? What does it look like to you?
In one sense, it looks like the culmination of a bunch of cultural phenomena that we have seen going way back into our roots of individualism, mistrust of centralized authority, mistrust of elites, and to some extent to the mistrust of academic elites in particular. We want to do it for ourselves. We want to see it for ourselves. And one of the remarkable things is that every year in our introductory course, we have our students go through a case study, which is about how do we do science and how do we find out whether something is acceptable or not. And one of the questions we ask them at the end is, well, tell us something that would give you more confidence in your assessment of whether these scientists did a good job or not. And about 25% of them say, I would be more confident in the result of this research if I could do it myself, if I could participate in it. And it's not an unusual response. And then we point out to the students that there are 15,000 clinical trials a month in this country that are registered with the federal government. And I don't know how many other bits of research there are out there, but it's clearly impractical for us to get our confidence in science only because we have done it ourselves. So we have to understand the process a little bit better. And that really is on us at the university to do a better job of getting that point across. Now, the next generation science standards are meant to try to bring that understanding as a part of general science education.
Is there a general misunderstanding of even what science is set up to do, do you think?
In one sense, yes. We see this also in some of our political leaders and their expectation that the purpose of science is technology. The purpose of science is to make something better for us, Tang or computers, or it's worth spending all of that money to go to the moon if, as a result of that, we get something tangible out of it. And so this is, you know, this is sort of what we expect. We confuse the aims that certainly science does have a practical application in many cases. But really the foundation of this is a better understanding rather than anything practical. Naturally, a better understanding will give us practical things that work. But we tend to think about Thomas Edison as a great scientist. Well, he was a great inventor. And he figured out how to apply the science in lots of things. So I think that's part of it.
Well, and so why do you think the gap has opened where people – on one hand, have trust in science when it meets their needs, but are skeptical of science when it doesn't? I mean, have scientists and the scientific community made mistakes that essentially open the door to the skepticism that exists today across ideological lines?
Well, I'm not sure it's so much a mistake as the actual nature of the process of science. I mean, the fact is that many of our favorite things that we know today, like continental drift, for example, were roundly rejected by the scientific community in the beginning. And for quite some time, until the appropriate evidence and the appropriate understanding was made available and could be applied to the problem. So part of the problem is really a problem of authority. That is, we scientists have made a big deal about the fact that science is revisable. Science can be tentative, can be changed when new information comes along. And we get into an issue with, well, how is that authoritative? If you guys are going to change your mind, you know, in 60 years, why should we believe you now, especially when it contradicts the experience that we have? I mean, global warming, the weather around here has been unusually cold for the last several weeks, and it's going to come again. And that's the question that people ask. And you know, it's some of the things that we talk about in science are counterintuitive. They don't match people's immediate experience.
Well, so how would you recommend that we evaluate science when it does contradict what our experience is if science changes from time to time?
That is probably the essence of the understanding of science. And again, when we're looking at the next generation science standards, what we're looking at is to get people to understand the process better. Part of it is not helped by the fact that every time a university professor publishes a paper, somebody in the PR department puts out a press release. And we had an article a couple of years ago, Eric Meikle and I, and it was that whole issue. You know, you see when a new fossil appears, it changes everything we know about evolution. Well, the fact is it almost never does. And that was a point of our article. We had looked at human fossils and we had said, you know, when was the last time a human fossil discovery changed absolutely everything we knew about the history of our species? And we couldn't find one. And the fact is that in overview, that's very, very well understood. It is true that we get some details that change because those are things that are unknown to us. There are some things that we can't know. If we discover a fossil that's 6 million years ago that we have never seen before, it's new evidence and that needs to be evaluated. But the fact is that if we've done science well, what we have is a large perspective that helps us to see where things fit. And the details are the things that are much more likely to change over the long run. So this kind of idea of the lone scientist who makes a discovery that turns the entire universe on its head is wrong. It's a very rare phenomenon that such a thing happens. But there are some really great things that happen. The first vaccination, for example, was a really great thing. And it probably affected the outcome of the American War for Independence because George Washington, I am told, wanted his troops vaccinated against smallpox, whereas the British didn't. That gave them some line of resistance to one of the things that used to kill warriors more than anything else, which was disease. So there are big events in science, for sure. And those are things that help transform our understanding. But they transform our understanding more than they transform the evidence that we have.
There are some who say that this is not an issue of putting more facts out there, that there are lots and lots and lots of facts. But this is an issue of trust in people as much as it is trust in statistics.
Rather than use the trust word and the belief word and all of those kinds of words, it really is more confidence in the reliability of the process, that this is a way of untangling complicated things to help us understand them. And if we do it right, then it helps us to predict things that we have not yet seen.
How much of an issue do you think is the idea of confirmation bias?
Confirmation bias is one of those things that we admit is a problem that other guys are having.
And I feel like by asking this question, I have some amount of confirmation bias.
You know, what we do is we collect data and we begin to look at the data and we begin to see patterns. And humans do that. They see patterns in lottery numbers. They see patterns in things that really don't have any strong pattern of
this one. This is why people are hypochondriacs.
That's true. And so one of the things that that we see as we do that is we make a decision in the process of doing research what is worth looking at and how we should look at it. And so the way that we check that and the way we should check that is this whole peer review process where you get anonymous people who can look at your stuff and they can tell you all the things they think are wrong with it. And then you can have, you know, an argument with them about it sometimes. And this is a process we all go through. It was probably the most frustrating part of publishing anything in the sciences because you'll have all these people telling you, you know, what's wrong with what you did. And the process of fixing that is really part of the process of combating this confirmation bias. So you're much more likely to see it in those press releases because the, you know, the PR person at the university is just listening to what the scientist says, and he says, "Well, I've just, you know, I've just saved the world, and this is, you know, brand new discovery that's going to change everything." Most likely, you're not going to see that in the article that comes out in Nature or the Journal of the American Medical Association. It's going to be much more conservative in terms of its inferences, but it's just who we are as people. And I think that's partly the tension that we have between this is a human endeavor. It's science is a human endeavor, and it is imperfect.
At the same time, confirmation bias exists among lay people as well. And there are some who say this is exactly why issues like vaccination and climate change are such flashpoints, because people find the science that supports what they believe.
It reminds me of when I was just finishing college many, many years ago. I lived with a family in Vermont, and the grandmother lived with them. And Granny Lavoie, every morning, would take down a rusty nail and put it in her tea and brew her tea with a rusty nail. And she said that was so that she didn't have iron deficiency. Now, there is no way to explain to Granny Lavoie that the particular form of iron that was in her rusty nail was probably not doing her any good physiologically, but Granny Lavoie had never had iron deficiency anemia in her 97 years of life. But the idea is that, you know, we have these experiences that we relate to certain things, and if they're not harmful, then certainly they cause no harm. Nothing terrible was happening to Granny Lavoie from the rusty nail in her tea, so that's great. Maybe nothing good was happening either, but, you know, that's confirmation bias. With vaccines, you know, what's interesting is we just had a conversation, or it's ongoing right now in the listserv that I share with science teachers, particularly biology teachers around the country. And we're seeing there a lot of anecdotes about a niece or a nephew or a son or a daughter who was, quote, perfectly fine and then had a vaccination. And then a couple of weeks later, people started noticing certain kinds of developmental defects. And they don't form a particular pattern. It isn't necessarily autism or ASD. It is a variety of things. And one of the issues with that is that what we see is, you know, an event, and then we see another event, and the tendency we have is to put them together and say one causes the other. The fact is that the developmental schedule for the immune system that we use to figure out when to give the vaccinations and the developmental events that allow us to detect certain types of neurological and cognitive disorders are pretty much in parallel with each other. So for many of these children, you wouldn't be able to detect the cognitive changes that are associated with something like autism before the time that we do. And it happens to be very close to the time when we give the injections. So the science behind that is pretty solid. The problems that we have seen, for example, in the outbreak of measles at Disney really has to do with the fact that there's a large group of children not vaccinated, and that means that whenever they get together and get exposed to the disease, there is a relatively large pool that will allow this disease to be spread, and that's how we get, you know, how we get these epidemics. And the issue really is, on an individual basis, parents are very worried, and it's what we do as parents. You know, the most tragic thing is for something to happen to our kids. We would all rather die than have something terrible happen to our kids. And so if there's something to worry about, we worry about it. And one of the things that we see with all vaccinations is that there is a known risk for a variety of things that can go wrong with a child that's vaccinated. And so we have a certain level of encephalitis, of brain inflammation, with the MMRV that we give for measles, mumps, German measles, and chickenpox. And we also have a level of that same complication with children who are infected naturally. And when you look at the CDC data and the World Health Organization data, the rate at which these brain inflammations happen just for measles is 125 times higher than for the four virus vaccines that are included in that one shot that the kids get. The piece that came out in the New York Times a few weeks ago looked at vaccination rates in California and found that there were some communities in which the percentage of unvaccinated children was close to 50%. And that, which we have normally associated with poor immigrant populations coming in from the third world, from Asia, from Africa, this is Marin County. These are affluent, well-educated people. This is putting their children at greater risk of harm than if they had them vaccinated, as if they should ever become exposed to measles. You know, that's the thing that we don't know. That's the unknowable part of this.
Well, it is all food for thought. Andrew Petto, thanks so much for helping us break through some of these questions.
Always a pleasure, Mitch.
Dr. Andrew Petto is a senior lecturer in science education, evolution education, and gross anatomy at UW-Milwaukee, and he's on the board of governors for the National Vaccine Education Project.
A quick break now, and then a preview of the new production at the Florentine Opera, Elmer Gantry, on stage this weekend. Keep listening. It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.
Career selling this junk. Happy to dine box. And
Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Sinclair Lewis's 1927 novel Elmer Gantry is considered one of the masterpieces of early 20th century American literature. It tells the story of an old-time preacher who tries to cover his predilection towards worldly interests like money and girls over saving souls.
80 years after the book was published, it was adapted as an opera. The Florentine Opera won a 2011 Grammy Award for its recording of it. The company presents a new production of Elmer Gantry this weekend, and ahead of that, we're joined in the studio by mezzo-soprano Catherine Procht, bass Kevin Burdett, and conductor Christopher Larkin, who says he has an unusual in to the work.
Robert Aldrich, the composer, and I happen to live in the same town, so it's been great to be able to have him come over to the house and sit down and talk about the piece, and we can go through things. I can ask, you know, is this what you meant here? You know, it's a slight difference in rhythm here from the first time this happened. Did you mean for this to be an eighth and for this to be a quarter? And we talk about, you know, tempos and maybe moving here a little bit or pulling back there. So it's such a I always think how great it would be to be able to email Mozart or iChat with Mozart and say, what were you thinking here? And what, you know. So there is, you know, the reason this is coming back, and I do want to thank Bill Florescu for asking me to be a part of this, because it's almost a victory lap for this piece, because as you know, it won 2 Grammys. And Bill had the desire to bring it back, but also to put a fresh stamp on it with a completely new cast and a new conductor. Only to just get a fresh take on it, a fresh outlook on it. The only holdover is Frank Kelly, who sang the role of Eddie in the original production, but is now making his stage directing debut with this piece. And it's just been such a treat to have Frank in the room and to have that wealth of experience that he brings to the piece, because he was in on the original workshops in Boston that started in 1992. So he's lived with this piece for a long time and has done that incredibly difficult aria of Eddie's, but also, you know, has a sense of how the piece has developed and grown over the years and was part of that original production. So it's great to have him next to me all the time.
That institutional knowledge has to be just wonderful.
Oh, it's fantastic.
To be able to draw
it's
on.
It's fantastic. Yeah.
And so, Katie and Kevin, you are new to this piece. Yeah. And so you're in this kind of rethinking of it. What is it like for you to come in on something that is an award-winning opera, but we're in a kind of a new way of thinking about it?
I mean, I do a lot of new work, and I really love the fact that this one has been done before, so there is a recording to listen to. And, you know, I like the idea, too, that there's a book. I was able to read the book. I was able to watch the movie and hear the recording. And because of Skype, I was able to talk to Herschel Garfein, the librettist, and kind of get an idea of what the character was supposed to be. But the thing I like most about doing new opera, new work, is that I don't have 200 years of past recording and experience to have to be compared to. I get to create my own character. And I generally try to play myself as the character anyway, try to sing with my voice and not try to recreate what I've heard before. So while it's great to have a reference with the recording, it's also lovely to put it away and just rely on, you know, on my musical skills and, you know, and coaching and creating role the way I would do it myself.
Right. It's you have only one recording to put away.
Correct. As opposed to 30.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And Kevin, for you?
Oh, for me, it's just a joy to be able to be a part of this production. I've known Herschel for years and sort of out of that decided to go see the world premiere production. It was, I think it started in Nashville. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. And then it went to Montclair State just out of New York City. And so I was able to go and see the production and I was overwhelmed by it. I was so moved. I felt like there's something about it that really resonated very deeply with me, and I was weeping, no joke, just so absorbed in the music and in the production that I spent the whole night weeping, and later told Herschel, man, it would be such a pleasure, such an honor to be able to perform that opera, and it's got legs. I'm sure it will be done again because it's such a fantastic opera. So when Mr. Florescu called, I jumped at the opportunity.
But you can't cry during this. You have to actually sing.
Oh, just watch me. What you don't get is I'm singing T.J. Rigg. I have very little to sing, so I can cry the whole show, basically.
Okay.
You won't even know the difference.
Just turn up stage. And, yeah.
But it's so it's a total joy. And to come in with a new piece, new to us and relatively new to the world, it's nice to be able to trust the composition team. You know, I've seen it, so I know it's genius. And also be able to trust the production team. When you see that Maestro Larkin is working on the show, you know you're going to come in and know someone who has really dug deep into the music, into the text, and will be able to sort of like an onion, just peel back what Bob was looking for. And so it's to sort of come in and to know the music and have your own ideas, but also trust that Frank, who knows it as well as anyone, and the maestro are going to be able to guide you. It's sort of it's a real pleasure. It's a really safe feeling, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it sounds like it's safe in the way that it allows you to really explore.
That's right.
And go out. You have that wonderful foundation.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? Yeah. I feel like rehearsals are like a big sandbox, and I get to play and play, and they'll tell me. Maestro will tell me and Frank will tell me if the sand's going out of the sandbox. But as you sort of get to discover it and still know it's part of the – it's in the right sort of milieu. It's in the right sort of – it's the right tone because you can trust them.
Do you think that Elmer Gantry, this particular opera, is sort of – where American opera is going? Because this is such a particularly American score, American story. We have the living librettist and the composer. And it seems like that this is so peculiarly American.
It is. But I think that's part of the subject matter. You know, it's very gospel influenced, this score. There's gospel going throughout the whole opera and these incredible big, big gospel scenes, big numbers that just crescendo to the end of the scene. So I think that's part of it. I don't think – you know, we have Dead Man Walking, pieces like that which are drawn from American film or American literature. So it could be, but not necessarily purely Americana. But I think this piece, you know, there are so many American themes going through it. Football. Elmer's a football player. Frank throws a little baseball reference in there. We hear the locomotion and electricity, all these things sort of becoming developed. So it is a real American piece. What yeah. I would like to say is this cast is just fantastic, just a fantastic group of people. Not only is Frank great at the helm, and not only the artist next to me, but Craig Verm, who's singing Elmer, and the rest of the cast down the line are just so committed to the piece. It's a real treat. And in some ways, it's nice that everyone is new to the piece. You don't have people from the old production. And not that there's anything wrong with that, but just so there's not a person, well, we did this last time, it almost helps sort of level the playing field for everyone involved.
And it's like what Katie was saying about having only that one recording.
That's
in this
right.
case, you know, you've got kind of a fresh eyes from everybody.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's why I love doing new pieces as well. It's more of a creative process, I think. You don't have that tradition. You know, when I do a piece like Bohème, which I've now done many, many times, but there are so many recordings. You have to listen to them all, you know, really, you do, just to see what's out there and then come up with your own take on what you would like to do the piece. Here, I love being, especially on premieres, because it gives you a chance to not only talk with the composer, but to create rather than recreate. You know, you really are creating for the first time something and hopefully putting a very personal stamp on it. And I find it much more, the process much more creative than trying to recreate.
The one thing that I think of, though, with all of this is that audiences tend to go to the things that they know. You know, it's very difficult. Mm-hmm. One of the truisms of radio is that you go where the audience is. You don't try to bring them to you. And I think that might be true for, you know, opera and theater and classical music as well. You've got an audience that thinks they know what they like. Mm-hmm. You know, they want their Mozarts and they want their Brahms and they want Bohème and they want, you know, whatever. But how do you meet them with a piece, a new piece like this, you know, or any new piece, particularly opera, which already has a reputation that's not deserved but is out there as being sort of elitist and not really for everybody.
Right.
You know, how do you bring them in?
Well, this wasn't always the way it was. You know, in Rossini's day, it was always – people were anxious to hear the next new thing. You know, he would write so many operas in 1 year, and he would even be criticized if he stole something from a previous – oh, that sounds just like Barbara Seville. And I think what will keep this art form alive is to keep creating and doing new things. And people will – you know, not that we want to get rid of all that fantastic. You know, there's nothing more beautiful than Marriage of Figaro. I think it's one of the most perfect pieces ever written. You would never want to not do that in a season or any of the great Bohème. I love the third act of Bohème is just a masterpiece, you know. But at the same time, we need to keep the art form alive and growing and nurture the old stuff and also produce new things. And as Bill for Rescue is doing, bringing it back for a second time. So people say, maybe I should have seen it the first time. Or even those people who saw it once will now see it again. So they feel like they're coming in with the background that they might say, well, I saw Boheme. I think I'll see it again because I enjoyed it the first time. You know, it's a financial risk with companies to produce new pieces because they don't know if they're going to get the audience. And it's up to, you know, general directors and producers to take that risk sometimes.
And for singers,
mm-hmm, yeah.
I think you make a wonderful point, and it sort of ties back into an earlier question when you said, is this sort of the way American opera is going? And I wonder if this opera, if Elmer Gantry, wasn't sort of on the vanguard of this – a new wave that I sense in mm-hmm. American opera, at least, of producing and creating new opera. Speaking just from my vantage point, I'm doing 4 world premieres this year, 3 in Dallas and 1 in Santa Fe, like big companies – putting on and taking the risk and creating new opera. And I think that's sort of a new – it's getting momentum. And I wonder if Gantry wasn't sort of on the forefront of that.
It was the thing maybe that pushed everybody else to say, maybe we can do this.
Yeah, we can do this. Mm-hmm. And you wonder if not. And part of – you know, it's – I think it's fascinating because one of the great things about Gantry is – the Americanism is the sort of the accessibility of it, but it's also extremely sophisticated music. Mm-hmm. And so this sort of ability to tie together accessible tunes that just grab you immediately and have it sophisticated, and it's based on a novel that is on the public consciousness, right? Like you hear Elmer Gantry. I had never read the book and I had never seen the movie, but you hear Elmer Gantry go, oh, yeah, I know Elmer Gantry. And you're like, who wrote that? Oh, Sinclair Lewis, that's neat. But even that sort of takes away some of the inherent
– oh, this is so new, I can't do it.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So for an audience, it's more accessible because, oh, Elmer Gantry, I know what that is, or I could.
Or maybe I do, yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, well, like Little Women and Moby Dick.
Well,
sure.
It's like Moby Dick,
yeah.
That's
Everest.
Right. Uh-huh. Everest is, well, Into Thin Air. I'm doing Cold Mountain this summer. There's an immediate sort of, you know what, I want to give this a shot. It's something new, it's something exciting, and there's a reference point I can tie into beyond the fact that, why are they just singing? Why don't they talk?
And there are I was going to say, I think what I'm noticing is that there are lots of books and movies that are being, you know, chosen because it's something that's familiar, that's going to be appealing to an audience. Manchurian Candidate is opening tonight. Dead Man Walking is another one, you know, and JFK is something that's being written and workshopped right now. I think that kind of general appeal is something that will bring people in. I have friends who aren't in the business but who do want to come because they don't want to see the same old thing. They want to see something different and new. And I think that just because people choose to write a libretto or to write music to these very familiar stories doesn't mean that that language is going to be what you expect. The musical language is going to be what you expect. Neither does it mean that the story that you've read is going to be the same thing you see on the stage. You know, they have to create a libretto from that book or from the movie.
Absolutely.
So there's a lot of adjusting that happens, and I think that, you know, it's an adventure. It's an adventure that the audience comes on with us.
Well, what's exciting to me is that it seems like that adventure, people are embracing it.
Absolutely.
And, you know, that, as you say, it's a risk, but producers and general managers and singers and conductors, everybody is kind of out there going, you know, this is a risk worth taking.
Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That this isn't a museum art form.
That's right. And it's not – the idea of basing an opera on found literature is hardly new. Like, you know, you have – I guess, you know, all the Beaumarchais trilogy is the basis of Figaro and Nozze and all that. And there's a real art to it too. Like, so one of the great things I think about this piece is the way Herschel – was able to sort of find a keyhole into the story and distill the story. I mean, Gantry is a very long novel.
Yeah.
Lewis was not a
short
story writer. No.
Revenue was not his thing. And to be able to sort of find that keyhole in and be able to tell the story in a distilled version, especially when most of it's sung, which so everything gets elongated anyway, there's a real art to that. And that's, I think, part of the genius of this work is someone who could, like Katie was saying, it's a different language. It's not unlike Shakespeare into opera is a really difficult jump, and it takes a librettist like Boito or the Britten Pair sort of turning it on its head in Midsummer Night's Dream and to make it sort of relatable in an operatic sort of milieu where it's you can have a soundscape. Anyway, I think I'm kind of babbling.
No,
I'm really good.
No,
is this
not.
On?
It's basically it's its own art form. It's somebody has to have the skill to be able to do that. Just
absolutely.
Because you can write the book doesn't mean you can write the libretto.
Absolutely, right. They're very different.
You have to know how to edit too. I mean, there are some things that we love so much about these stories that we you know want to hear and we expect to hear as we come into the opera, and they've been edited out because they just. They add on something that has nothing to do with the core of what we're trying to say in the story. In the
right.
Opera.
Yeah. Risking the wrath of the book lovers.
Yes.
Wait,
yeah.
That was my favorite scene.
Right.
You took that out. Yeah.
Katie and I actually had the opportunity to do Little Women several years ago, and that's a classic example of a book that's, 3 inches thick, that Mark Adamo himself, he wrote his own libretto and condensed it down to very universal human themes and did leave out some – there's a whole piano scene that he left out from the book that I missed. But at the same time, it's very powerful because he chose themes that everyone could relate to, letting go of the past in a way and letting go of certain things to move on in life. But the relationship between librettist and composer is so important, and I think – I know that Bob and Herschel work so closely together on this. They really sit down and work together a lot of the time as Bob is composing. It makes such a huge difference. And I know Jake Hague is the same way, Gene Shear and Jake Hague, that that relationship between a composer and a trusted librettist is just so important.
What I want to do right now is thank you, all three of you, for coming in and talking about this and about your passion, about new work and about this work in particular. Break a Leg, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Mezzo-soprano Catherine Procht sings the role of Sharon Falconer. Bass Kevin Burdett is T.J. Rigg. And Christopher Larkin conducts the Florentine Opera's production of Elmer Gantry. It runs this Friday and Sunday at the Marcus Center. There is more information from a link at WUWM.com.
Another break now, and in just a few minutes, a Wisconsin native singer-songwriter John Stotts previews some songs from his brand new album. Keep listening. This is Lake Effect from WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Earlier this year, we spoke with Ed Janis, who is curating an audio archive project of Wisconsin farmers and farm families called The People Remember. Ed has offered to share some of the stories he collects, including this one.
Margaret Klessig wouldn't have expected to spend her life on a Wisconsin dairy farm. She was born into a prosperous family in Vienna, Austria. But she settled in Wisconsin when she married Eddie Klessig, a farmer radical who thought that nature has equal rights.
Eddie loved farming. He loved the land. He loved what he was doing. You didn't just want to have a machine that runs back and forth and exploits the land and not replenish it with the manure and so on. I mean, Eddie went to short course, and he graduated from that, and he had Alder Leopold as a teacher, and believe it or not, but Alder Leopold influenced him a whole lot. We went out into nature. And that was always our delight. And so very early I learned, about mushrooms and the wildflowers and so on. And this love of nature, that I grew up with that it was very important. Nature is divine. Edward's father didn't believe in, spending all his money on machinery. So we had horses yet. And I remember Eddie asked me if I wanted to learn how to handle horses, and he let me cut a field of hay, not a whole field, but at least he set me on this thing, and I thought, this is absolutely divine, the fragrance of the hay, and the blue sky with a few clouds up above, and here I am, like a princess.
Margaret Klessig, recorded by curator Ed Janis for his project The People Remember, chronicling stories of rural Wisconsin. You can find out more about it from a link at WUWM.com.
wasting money like it's free.
You can take John Stotts out of the Midwest, but you can't take the Midwest out of John Stotts. The Madison native now lives in Colorado, but he's back home in Wisconsin for the release party for his new CD. The album features another transplanted Wisconsinite, Jeffrey Foucault, producing and on guitar.
Stotts will join Milwaukee musician Haywood Williams for the show tomorrow night at Club Garibaldi in Milwaukee. But ahead of that show, he spent some time with us in the Lake Effect Performance Studio. We're hearing the title track from the album called Tulsa.
Working late into the mornings, sleeping through the afternoon. I still dream of Arizona, but I guess Tulsa has to do.
John Stotts in Lake Effect's Performance Studio with Tulsa, the title track of the about-to-be-released album. John,
yep.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Great tune.
Thank
you. Tell me a little bit about it. What did you actually break down?
Well, no, it's partially based on I played in Tulsa like once a long time ago at a coffee shop on the outskirts of town. Wasn't a great gig. I think I made like $20, and I was staying at a KOA across from a casino outside of town. And I thought, you know, it would be really depressing to just climb into my tent at 9 o'clock at night because it was an early gig. And so I thought I'd go try my luck at the casino and lost my $20 really quickly, had a kind of negative Tulsa experience. So I kind of drew on that and, like, created another story about
it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Tulsa does not come out well. No. But you have moved to Denver, but you're originally from Wisconsin, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, Madison, I think you said? Yeah.
Yep.
So, and I know that you've spent time musically with some of the folks that have spent a lot of time in this studio, like Jeffrey Foucault and Peter Mulvey.
Mm-hmm.
And were they people that you looked up to when you were first starting and thinking, I want to do this?
Definitely. I mean, when I was like a sophomore in college, I was going to UW Oshkosh, and a friend and I drove down to the Cafe Carp to see Peter Mulvey and Jeffrey Foucault play, and that was the first time I was introduced to them. So we're talking like 2003, I think. And yeah, I mean, those guys have both been gigantic influences on me.
Had you wanted to do it before you heard them? Were you already kind of starting on the path?
I was, like, I'd written a song, I think, you know, but I think that those guys really kicked it into another level for me. Before hearing them, I was probably more into like the Ben Harper, the kind of more poppy songwriting vein, and they kind of centered me around the Americana thing, you know.
What do you think it is about Wisconsin? There's a lot of really amazing singer-songwriters that come from this state.
Yeah.
What do you think it is about the experience of being here?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's a real place with beautiful scenery and really nice people and great cities and its share of other, you know, difficulties that I think inspire songs, you know. I mean, I think it's just a real place. It's not perfect, but it's also, you know, great. And I think that maybe that inspires people, a bit of the good and the bad together.
Now that you've moved away and you live in Denver, do you recognize more clearly how it's influenced the way you write from here?
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's a big difference between songwriters coming out of Wisconsin and songwriters that, like, are from Denver or like, a lot, you know, bluegrass is really huge out there, and it's just a different scene. I don't know a ton of really, like, rootsy Americana types coming out in Denver, you know. Those kind of songwriters seem much more centered in, like, Madison and Milwaukee, Fox Valley, Eau Claire kind of thing.
Now that you're out there doing what you do, do you find you have an audience? Are people interested because it is different?
I do have an audience somewhere. You know, I haven't really worked super hard to cultivate like a real local following out there. I've been doing a lot of like touring out of Colorado, so I just haven't made a point of as much as I should have of like focusing on like being a Denver songwriter, you know. I didn't move there for the scene. I moved there because I wanted mountains and I liked the city. So
yeah.
it wasn't like a calculated, like, I am going to break out of the Denver music scene sort of thing. Yeah.
Well, but travel seems to be a huge part of what influences you, period, because mm-hmm. you've done a whole lot of touring and traveling and not just in the United States.
I love travel. It's, you know, one of my biggest influences. I just played a first show in Mexico City, which was really fun. But that was more just like my girlfriend and I wanted to go for a trip. And I was like, well, I'm going to play a show while I'm there, you know. I've traveled and played around Europe and like weird places in Eastern Europe, you know, like playing a show in an abandoned bicycle factory in Slovenia. Or those kind of places definitely resonate with
me. I have to ask, where in Slovenia?
It was in Ljubljana.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was like a squatter's place, like this abandoned bike factory that the government kept like threatening to tear down. And they were just like, you're going to have to bulldoze it with us in it. And so they just set up a music venue in there and there's families living and they have an art space. It's pretty cool.
And Ljubljana is a beautiful city.
It's
too.
Amazing.
Yeah. And you traveled around in Budapest, I think you were. I saw
mm-hmm.
on your page and
yeah,
in Sarajevo.
And
you, of course, got a song about getting into Sarajevo.
Yep.
And that was on the last album, right?
On the one that came out in 2010, Ghost Towns. And then there's a newer one since that.
Okay.
Old Fashioned, yeah.
Yeah. Which is a Frightened Rabbit song. We were talking about that. And I love have you played in Glasgow?
I haven't, no. I have. I was in Scotland only when I was, I think I was 16 on a family trip. I did the UK trip
right.
when I was younger.
So, well, then you that's the next step is you got to get into – Glasgow has some amazing venues.
I would love to go there.
Amazing venues. And the singer-songwriter, the Americana thing is actually quite big there.
Yeah, I've heard.
Which is really kind of fun when you think about it. So,
yeah.
Well – the songs we're hearing today are all from the new upcoming album. Before we get into the next song, tell me a little bit about it. Did I understand that Jeff Foucault is your producer on this?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, Jeffrey Foucault produced it. I flew out to the East Coast and we did it in Vermont during the polar vortex in like a recording studio that was attached to a cabin with a wood stove. It's how you're supposed to make an album, I think. I'm pretty sure.
Well, then tell me about this song that we're going to hear, Old Pro.
This is one of the earlier ones I wrote for the album. It's a fictional thing, but it's kind of like about a retired football player. You know, we hear all the stuff about head injuries and how maybe the post-football life isn't so glamorous for a lot of guys. And so that's kind of what I had in mind for this one. And there's a little Easter egg in it for Packer fans, too.
Oh, perfect. Perfect. Well, here's John Stotts in Lake Effect's performance studio with Old Pro.
Middle-aged, last time on the field, it's been a good career. I got this girlfriend, she's been good to me. Maybe now things quiet, we can move on in. It told me not to spend my money quickly, and that I shouldn't drink too much. They said that I should look into some savings and not to get too far out of. Came quick, yeah, it snuck on me. That second kid we had made it hard to breathe. I still see your guys now and then. Ray's divorced, Max got cancer, and Willie still gets lit. Told me there'd be press jobs waiting after, and that I should keep myself in shape. My wife told me she was sick of losing, was all hers to take. '54 now, and it doesn't really seem that old.
John Stotts with Old Pro from the album Tulsa. John, thanks so much.
Thank you.
For you, when you're working on songs and getting them ready to tour or to put on an album or whatever, where do you start?
Some just come out randomly. Like I said, that one is one of the older ones, and I don't think I wrote that one with an album in mind. I was just, you know, writing a song. As, you know, we set the studio date this past January, and as it was approaching, I started to feel like, you know, the pressure of like, okay, I should try and write more songs so we maybe have a couple to toss out and we can take the best ones. And, you know, and Jeffrey was really good about giving me the right amount of pressure on that, you know, and giving me some parameters like, hey, maybe you should try one song where it's like four chords, no chorus, like something that we can try and, you know, have the band really jam on for a while, you know. As an album approaches, I start to feel more of the pressure, and I kind of like that. I feel like it gets me to write better. So there's kind of a mix of just songs that I wrote longer ago that don't have that same kind of drive through them, you know.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that you kind of need that little bit of pressure to kind of make the juices flow.
Yeah. You know, I'm one of those songwriters. I'm not super – like, I don't write daily. I don't write weekly. I haven't even written a real recent song in a few months here. And part of that is I just got done with a new album, and I just get into this total relaxed mode where I'm focused on everything else that's with that album, and I'm not working on writing. But it really – to get me to, like, 12 songs or something, you know, like, I need the pressure. Yeah.
Are there ever songs, though, that sort of insist that they get written? Have you found that to be true?
You know, sometimes you just sit down in the mood and something just comes out of you. And sometimes it happens the opposite for me, too, where I really have to work at it. Some songs I have to do, like, research for, you know. I write a lot of historical songs or songs that I at least want to be partially factual. So if I'm naming places, I'm not just, you know, making them up. Yeah.
Right. So, John, thanks so much for stopping by and playing some songs. What are you going to take us out with?
This song's called Home at Last.
Midway to Denver, over the plains. Don't wait up, I'll be home late.
John Stotts is home at last in Wisconsin for the release of his new CD called Tulsa. He'll play a concert tomorrow evening at Club Garibaldi on a bill with Milwaukee's Hayward Williams. You can hear all three songs that John played for us at WUWM.com. And I'm Bonnie North. John Strelecki engineered our interview with John Stotts, which takes us out today.
I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 o'clock. For another edition of Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, your NPR station in Milwaukee.
Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.
Coming home at last.